Professor Hausman.
Well, thank you very much. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be here. This is my first meeting of the World Science Forum, so I'm extremely impressed by all what I have learned in the last couple of days. So let me tell you what it is that I work on. I work on the following simple questions. You know, why are some countries rich and other countries poor? Why are some countries catching up and others not? And what can be done to accelerate the process? So that's the essence of the questions I'm asking myself. And, you know, a simple fact about the world is that in many countries of the world, the US included, incomes per capita have gone up by a factor of 25 over the last two centuries. Now, the puzzle is, if this is a phenomenon that happened in part of the world, did it happen everywhere in the world, and if not, why? So here is a graph that shows how many times is the US richer than these other countries. Okay, you see that between 1820 and 1970, the US went from being like 2.5 times richer than China to being 20 times richer than China in incomes per capita. So this phenomenon of a 25-fold increase in incomes per capita in the US was not a universal phenomenon. It was a concentrated phenomenon. In huge parts of the world, it didn't happen. Okay? Now, if you look at the last 30 years, now China is catching up. So the US is now only like 5 times richer than China and something like 10 times richer than India. But the world is still diverging in other parts. The US, the gap with Nigeria has been growing, not declining over the last 40 years. So what's going on? Why is this phenomenon of rising incomes per capita not a shared global experience? So why did the US become 25 times richer? Well, you know, there was a traditional way of thinking about this issue is that, you know, workers today are working maybe with more land, more capital, more education, and consequently they can produce more. Well, economic research has found out that the answer to this hypothesis is no, that this is not what happened. That what happened essentially is that we learned how to make more products, different products, better products in better ways. So it's not that we are producing 25 times more of the products that we were producing in 1820, right? It's that we're producing a completely different set of products with completely different tools and techniques, right? So we have learned as a society, if you want, to make more and better products in better ways. Now, when you say we have learned, who the hell is we? What does the we stand for? What is this we that has learned? And here I would like to contrast learning between, say, two different sets of communities. For example, I'm going to ask the question, who has more knowledge? This Inuit man, here is the Inuit man producing food. This is the food industry. This is the construction industry. And this is the transportation industry. Okay? Now, so that's the Inuit, and this is modern man. Now, who knows more? Who knows how to make more things? So this guy is using a shirt, doesn't have a clue how to make a shirt, using a tie, doesn't know how to make a tie. He's using scissors and a phone, doesn't know how to make that either. And he has no clue how to make a computer or how to make the software programs he's using. This guy is completely useless. You put this guy one night in the Arctic and he dies. He doesn't live to see the following morning. So this is a completely useless man. Right? It's illogical to say that he knows more than the Inuit. So, as individuals, we are not more learned than we used to be 200 years ago. We can only make this statement at the social level. At the social level, we know more because each one of us knows a little bit of things. We don't know how to make most of the things we use, but in the aggregate, we know more because more knowledge has been distributed throughout society. Okay? And that's the essential message. In an Inuit society, everybody knows how to fish, how to make igloos, how to transport themselves with dogs and so on. We don't know how to make most of the things we use individually. It's only the society that it has learned. Now, productive knowledge, the knowledge that is used to make things, to do things, has to be in brains. It cannot be just on the web. This is an important point, because we think that just because we've put something on the web, it automatically moves into brains. It may make it easier to move it into brains, but it needs to get into brains. So for example, when your tooth hurts, you don't go to your significant other and ask them to download an article from Wikipedia, read it, and fix the problem for you, right? You actually need to go to a dentist. Right now, this dentist might have read an article on the web, but you need to have the knowledge in brains for that knowledge to be useful. So acquiring a productive knowledge is going to be a hard task. Now, let me show you just how hard it is. This is as talented a human being as you'll ever find. This is Michael Jordan. And, you know, here's an article by Sports Illustrated, why this guy is so great playing basketball. One day, the guy decided to become a professional baseball player. And soon after, Sports Illustrated was asking him to quit, because obviously he had not accumulated his 10,000 hours of experience that would allow him, you know, to find out to hit the ball in milliseconds and so on and so forth. So even the most talented people cannot know everything, right? They have to specialize. So because of this, we are, as individuals, are limited to in the amount of productive knowledge we can acquire. And I'm going to define the unit of productive knowledge, the maximum unit of productive knowledge that an individual can acquire, as one person byte. Okay? So we are limited as humans to one person byte of knowledge. And the question is, how can productive knowledge increase at the social level? And the answer, obviously, has to be that the only way productive knowledge can increase at the social level is if we distribute it. If we all have the same bit of knowledge, we are not going to increase productive knowledge at the social level. Okay? So for example, I teach at this institution here, and in this institution was created in 1636 in this building here. Okay? And in those days, a college degree lasted 4 years. Now, since 1636, to this day, knowledge has increased, and as a consequence of that, the university has increased, and it became bigger, and it's now even bigger, right? So you might imagine, with, say, a 50-fold increase in knowledge, we now require that a student study for 4 times 50, 200 years, right? No, that's not the way we do it. We actually have 50 different majors. We distribute the knowledge, bits of knowledge, to more places. But now what happens when you have distributed bits of knowledge to more places? You need to reaggregate that knowledge, right? To use it, now you need to reaggregate it. So productive knowledge is embedded in products. Most of us don't know what lipid salts are or how to synthesize them, but we all use soap, which is made out of lipid salts, to wash our hands. So the knowledge to make these things is embedded in the products that we use. Products differ in the number of person bytes they require. They differ in the informational content they require. And to create products with more than one person byte, you need to put humans to cooperate. You need to bring them together. And you bring them together in firms, so you need to put people with different skills together to work, or you can buy from other firms, so you can have to put firms together with firms to share the knowledge and make things. So, these complex networks of firms and markets is the way society accumulates and uses productive knowledge. That's what's happening on the institutional side to reflect this ur-substance productive knowledge that is being accumulated at the social level. So products differ in the quantity of productive knowledge they require. You can guess, you know, how many people need to be involved to produce this versus, say, these products, or here is, you know, the 787 that is produced in a bunch of different companies in a bunch of different countries. It requires the mobilization of a lot of knowledge. Now, to put these person bytes together, they have to cooperate. Now, in the US, the average employee works with 100 colleagues in a firm. So that gives you a sense of how complex is the stuff that they need to make, what is the diversity of talent that you have to mobilize to make things. India has 4 times the population of the US. So you would guess, you know, 100 workers, 4 times more people in India, it must be 4 times 100 is 400, say. Well, that's not the right answer. In India, the average person works in a firm of 4 workers. So with four workers, you can imagine what is the total amount of person bytes that they could mobilize? Well, at most four, right? So the complexity of the things that they can make is reflected in the kinds of organizations they build. So now it doesn't mean that, you know, size is the only thing that matters. Here is a firm in China that has, you know, many, many workers, but they are essentially all doing the same thing, right? So it doesn't mean that they're mobilizing many person bytes. Now, this is a different kind of firm. Each one here has a different person byte, right? And they are, you're combining these different person bytes to make more complicated things. So let me just say that we have, my time is up, we have developed a technique to measure the amount of productive knowledge that countries have. And this, we look at what countries make to infer what they know. And how much a country knows is very correlated with how rich they are, okay? So this is, on the x-axis is how much productive knowledge they have, and on the y-axis is how rich they are. Now, interestingly, this is India, which we would have thought should be much richer than it is given what it knows. And this is Greece, which we would have thought it should be much poorer than it currently is, given what it knows. Okay? Now, you might say, well, you know, your theory is wrong because India is poor and Greece is rich. And I might say, well, maybe the theory is wrong. Maybe the world is wrong. Right? Maybe the world will look like the theory in the sense that the knowledge of India is going to get expressed in higher incomes. And consequently, this actually should predict future growth, which it actually does. So this is a very good predictor of future growth. It's a much better predictor of future growth than, for example, education. So here is the relationship between our measures of productive knowledge that people have and the measures of schooling that are out there. And when we do a horse race between education and these measures of productive knowledge, well, we beat the hell out of them. So the point I'm finishing, the point is that productive knowledge is really what it's all about. Science is a member of the system that embeds the productive knowledge and that co-evolves with the productive knowledge. So we should think of ourselves as in the process of co-evolving with productive structures to embed productive knowledge in people and to evolve it. Thank you very much.